Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
The clerk will now read the names of the seventh group.
Romney, Rosen, Sanders, Sinema.
Well, my first priority is to form relationships with existing senators and incoming senators, because in the Senate, relationships are what matter the most.
I've talked to both of them. They both have made a commitment to try to work together, and that's another part of the key here. If you can work together, you can accomplish a lot more certainly than if you're trying to work at cross purposes.
Jeff Flake is now selling real estate or whatever he's doing. He'll probably go to work for CNN. That's my prediction. He was going to tell people how to win in 2020 because 2016 can't. He wrote a book about it. Didn't work out too well, that book, because we won in 2016 because we didn't want to wait till 2020.
And with us to talk about Arizona's new U.S. senators and former Senators Flake and Kyle and more, our public policy consultant and former legislative leader Chris Hurstam, and former state superintendent of public instruction Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Guys, welcome back. Happy New Year.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Jaime, let's talk about Sinema, McSally, just expectations going forward with the two of them. John Kyle even said he wants the two of them to work together. He expects them to. But that was a really bitter campaign. What do you see there?
It was a very bitter campaign. The thing with both of them is that they have a great deal of respect amongst their colleagues, not just within their particular caucuses, but I think they have a lot of respect with the business community, with other congressional leaders. The hard thing is going to be, and I've said this before here on the show, that the gravitas that Arizona's had, Arizona's always punched above our weight. They're still going to be very young in the process, and they're going to be very junior in the process. And that's going to be very difficult. We got massive issues coming down. Defense issues are going to be ongoing. There's the water issues that are ongoing. So they're going to need to, as much as possible, work together. And that's something John Kyle has been saying, because the gravity of the issues that Arizona is going to be facing, they're going to have to, in order to be successful, they're going to have to be aggressive in working together. I mean, hopefully that'll be the case.
Chris, will they?
No, I don't think they will. I'd love to say yes, but you always want me to be honest, right? For McSally, the campaign has begun. I mean, it has to. She's got to be on the phone raising money right now, and her pipeline to money is Mitch McConnell. And McConnell's proven that he's a toady to the worst president in the history of the United States, Donald Trump. And so I think McSally, waiting to be appointed. We had the nice photo of her and the tape of her with her dog and so forth, and it looked nice. But it'll still come down to a tough race. There's three vulnerable Republican, most vulnerable Republican seats that the Democrats will be going after. She occupies one of them. And I just think she's got to toe the line with Mitch McConnell, and he toes the line with Donald Trump. She embraced Trump figuratively and literally during the campaign and called Kyrsten Sinema a traitor in the one televised debate and never took it back. And I think it's galling for Sinema, frankly, to defeat McSally and then have to be in the U.S. Senate with her at the same time. And Sinema's a Grant Woods fan, and Grant Woods wants to run for the U.S. Senate against McSally. Mm-hmm. So I just think all these political dynamics will dominate.
Jaime, if they are able to work together, let's say that they're able to put sort of the past behind them and McSally's able to focus on the Senate and, work on the campaign at other times. Does that help the state maybe regain some of the, I don't want to call it seniority because they're obviously very junior in the Senate, but does that sort of help Arizona maybe continue, as you say, to punch above its weight if they're able to sort of unify on issues as opposed to one Democrat, one Republican going separate ways?
Absolutely. And, I'm not as pessimistic as my friend here on the left.
I'm a realist.
I just disagree. I think out of anybody that the Republicans could have had, Martha McSally brings, I think, a lot more gravitas. Again, with her colleagues and the people that she has worked with in Congress on both sides of the aisle, she has a great wall of respect. Kyrsten Sinema is also a pro. I mean, she's somebody that understands that if she's successful, and I think she will be successful, she will have to work with the Republicans. And she has done that her entire career. even though they've had a bitter campaign, Kirsten is somebody that I think could rise above it. And I think they'll be very smart in how they deal with it. I'm not going to discount the politics that are going to come into this and the attacks McSally's going to get very, very soon. But she has to be very deft, and she cannot be so much of a partisan, because I think that'll hurt her 2 years from now. I think she needs to show that she can be somebody that can work with Democrats.
The huge difference here is Sinema has a 6-year term. She doesn't have to worry about
Understood.
2 years from now.
Understood.
And McSally immediately has got to worry about it and fundraise.
But if McSally doesn't do this in the next 2 years, she will have only a 2-year term.
Yeah.
And that's it. And she'll be done.
Yeah.
So I think she's going to realize very quickly where she has to be seen as somebody that can get things accomplished.
And don't underestimate the I think Sinema will continue to play the centrist game that she plays so successfully, picking and choosing her votes. But it's not just a coincidence that she was mocked by McSally for the pink tutu, and she shows up to be sworn in a completely pink outfit. I mean, that was her way of saying, go ahead, mock me. I'm now being sworn in as a U.S. senator in pink. And there's that dynamic going on behind the scenes, and I just don't think you're going to find Sinema embracing McSally.
Let's ask one more question, Chris, about McSally specifically, because as Jaime mentioned, and you both mentioned, there's going to have to be a quick shift here. So is McSally the person who served in the House as a, you know, moderate to conservative person, or is she the person who was involved in that campaign, scorched earth plan, this sort of thing? There are so many negatives against McSally now because of that campaign. Does she go back to being the pragmatist, and does that work enough for her base?
No, I don't think it does. The very fact that she got squished for the U.S. Senate race in her own congressional district tells you a lot. I think they were fed up with her at the end because they watched her play that game. She decided to veer to the right to win the primary. She had to embrace Trump, and she never moved back towards the center in the general election. And that embracing of Trump is going to be a huge number one campaign issue that she's going to have to try to overcome. And I don't think she can, because Donald Trump will be on the ballot in all likelihood with her in 2020.
Well, I mean, briefly, does she have to act as though she's going to have a challenger from the right, probably not the left, but from the right in the primary, because she's been appointed?
She's going to definitely keep that in the back of her mind. I think she'd be stupid not to. I mean, she's going to make sure that her base is going to be with her. I think this time around, it'll be I'd be very surprised if she does get a challenge in the Republican primary. And that being
you
the
mean
case—
You mean a viable challenge or any challenge?
Because I think the Republicans are going to galvanize around McSally, and certainly nationally they're going to galvanize around McSally, and I think they're going to make it known that if anybody goes out against her, they're going to be very aggressive in defeating them, which gives her a little bit more space to in order to capture that centrist
Are they going to galvanize around Donald Trump?
Well, of course they are.
Yeah,
well,
and so it'll be a Trump— McSally
but, I mean,
ticket.
But,
That's
but
what
if
it's
McSally,
be.
But if McSally shows herself to be a viable senator and, again, proves that she can work across the aisle, then she becomes a – I'm not saying it's a slam dunk, but she becomes a more viable candidate.
Jaime, does the fact that she's used to running in 2-year increments help her in this regard?
Absolutely. I think it helps a lot. She knows how to fundraise. She's very adept at fundraising. And that's going to be key, is that they are going to need to – and being a U.S. senator also is helpful too, right? That's one of the best ways to raise money, is being an incumbent United States senator. And so her ability to raise money very quickly and building that war chest starting now is going to give her a little bit of an advantage.
Chris, how's this delegation in the House going to work together? We've got 5 Democrats, 4 Republicans. You know, there was a time when we heard about, back in the old days, of course, Arizona's delegation worked together. And then even more recently, Kyrsten Sinema, Matt Salmon were close. They were friends. Crossing the aisle, Ed Pastor, of course, another person who would cross the aisle, at least in that sense. So it looks like we've got some people on the pretty far right and the pretty far left. Do we have enough in the middle?
Yeah, as long as the 4 Republicans continue to be active in the Freedom Caucus, you know, the wacko side of the Republican Party in Congress, there's no room for them to work in a bipartisan manner. Well, Andy Biggs is not going to do that, and I think I don't see Lesko doing it at all as well. So I just I don't think you're going to see a lot of cooperation. The one issue that should pull them together is water. We'll see. I hope so. That's been our history in Arizona. But other than that one issue, you know, there's a litmus test. They all look at their base. They all look at their safe seat, you know, in their winning the primary, not having the Trump faction take them on in the primary. And that Freedom Caucus is toxic.
I mean, briefly, one thing that struck me, it was symbolic, I suppose, but after Congressman Pastore passed away.
Right.
And there was this gathering on the House floor of the Arizona delegation, all of them, Republicans and Democrats standing next to each other, except for Andy Biggs.
Right.
Was that good to see them do that, or was that just sort of this is a classy thing to do?
Well, I think both. It was good to see them do that. I thought it was a very classy thing for them to do. Certainly, Ed was somebody that demanded that respect because he was a legend for Arizona. I just wish they would do that more. I'm hopeful that they'll start to move in that direction, but I'm not holding my breath either.
I want to ask about some of the members of Arizona's delegation who are going to be in new roles now. You talk about somebody like Ruben Gallego, who has never served in the majority anywhere,
right,
either in the state or in Congress. Someone like Andy Biggs or Debbie Lesko, who have never served in the minority, either in the state legislature or in Congress. How does that changing dynamic affect individual legislators going from being the minority to the majority or vice versa?
Well, for the ones that have been in the majority, I think it's a more of a wake-up call because then they're going to realize, well, what do you mean I don't get these great offices anymore? What do you mean I don't have the pick of the staff? Well, what do you mean, you know, I don't get I'm at the bottom of the totem pole?
My bills don't get heard.
When you're in the minority in Congress, you really are treated as a second-class citizen, and they'll learn that very fast, and I think it's a rude awakening. When you get into the majority, it's a lot more fun, and I think you're going to have Ruben Gallego, you mentioned, is going to be very effective. Because having the strength of being in the majority, being able to then leverage that for a lot of the things that he wants to do in Arizona and position himself for other offices, that gives him a leg up on a lot of different things.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, yeah, I agree with Jaime on that. I think for Ruben Gallego, it's fascinating because now being in the majority for the first time, he's going to have, as Jaime pointed out, far more opportunities and a much bigger platform and more CNN and MSNBC appearances, et cetera. And so he's going to have to make a decision quicker than we think with regards to whether he likes that new power in the House or whether he wants to throw it away quickly and run for the U.S. Senate and take his chances. So the majority House situation for Gallego will be a determinant probably whether he runs for the Senate or not.
Is there also a change in terms of now you actually have to govern? Like in the minority, it seems it's a lot easier just to sort of scream into the wind and complain about things and throw rocks and all that. But when you're in the majority, you're actually expected to get stuff done.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and they sort of proved they could right off the bat last evening when they passed all the budget bills out and not one Democrat voted against it. And they got like seven Republicans to join them. And put it back in McConnell and Trump's corner with regards to the shutdown still going on. I think, you know, don't underestimate Nancy Pelosi's ability to hold them together. And that's another fascinating dynamic because in the past, when they were in the minority, Gallego would, and so did Sinema, they would pop off and say they didn't want Pelosi down the road as being their leader. But I notice now they're all sort of marching together for the heavenly cause of being in the majority in the House. And it's fun to watch politically.
That's Chris Hurstam. Also here is Jaime Molero with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday Newscap on the show here on 91.5 KJZZ. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Joining us, public policy consultant and former legislative leader Chris Hurstam and former state superintendent of public instruction, Jaime Molero of Molero Alvarez. Chris, you've had some strong things to say about Senator John Kyle, especially since he came back to serve this sort of interim period. He had a news conference the other day to say bye to this position. Just brief observations about, I guess I was thinking, this is not exactly a Michael Jordan comparison, but I was thinking when Michael Jordan came back to play for the Washington Wizards, is that sort of what happened with John Kyle here, where he had this reputation, which partisan, but also extremely capable and competent, and then came back for this interim term? What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I've expressed my view here before. I think it was a bad appointment because I really like John Kyle. I think he's as bright as anyone I've ever met. Very effective as a three-term senator and so forth for Arizona. I have nothing but high regards for him. But to come back after having been the Sherpa for Kavanaugh, and to take the position and have Ducey appoint him for just 4 months is ridiculous. Ducey should have appointed someone that would have served until the next election and not have this double appointment thing. I just don't think that was fair to the John McCain seat. That's just my own personal viewpoint. Kyle was a safe pick because that's who Trump and the Kavanaugh people wanted, to make sure they had a safe Kavanaugh vote, and they got it. But I just think to play this game for 4 months was sort of nonsensical. Now, I did like his comments about trying to have people work together, and he's encouraged both U.S. Senate senators now from Arizona to work together. That's all very nice and very dignified and very typical John Kyle.
Well, Mark's question even about being in the minority, the majority, I remember talking to John Kyle at times when he was in the minority. And he was a pragmatist, a very conservative person, but also a pragmatist. What about these 4 months? I mean, it's not going to wreck his legacy or anything, but it almost seems like it was trouble he didn't necessarily need.
Hey, that's probably true. But I disagree a little bit in that I think if John McCain were asked who would be a great replacement for him, he would say John Kyle in a heartbeat. I have no doubt about that. And I think what John Kyle did, I think, was bring stability in a situation when Arizona was going through. I mean, to lose a John McCain was a big deal for our state. And the moment after John Kyle was appointed by Governor Ducey, you just noticed that there was like a calmness now. People weren't as anxious anymore. And everybody was feeling like, okay, well, good. We got somebody that knows what he's doing, and albeit for a short time, but it allowed us to weather this process. And let's face it, for Ducey, it was a excellent pick. It took that issue off of his election. Mm-hmm. When everybody, if he would have made an appointment, that he could have been at a time when he wasn't at double-digit leads, as you recall. So that was something that was very deft on the governor's part, and I think it was good for Arizona. But of course, I was a former intern to then John Kyle, Congressman Kyle, so I'm very biased.
Was it possible, do you think, in such a short term for him to really have anything remotely close to the kind of impact he had for our state in the Senate over the time he was in Congress before?
No, just because of the Senate culture and the Senate processes, right? There's a very strong tradition on your seniority. And the moment John left as U.S. Senator but then came back, you know, you just don't have that same position. But where he was effective was his relationships with leadership and his relationships across the aisle. And if you noticed his going away, his speech where he talked about, you know, unanimity, he was still a workhorse. He was ticking off all of these very technical types of things that he did. And that's typical John Kyle. He was very much a workhorse.
Chris, finally, would we have been better off though, knowing for sure, I know these things have to be done behind the scenes, knowing for sure that John Kyle was absolutely going to leave at the end of December, as opposed to sort of playing this game for a while? I know behind the scenes people may have known, but we weren't sure. So that made this political more than it had to be.
Yeah, I think Ducey wanted as safe as pick as possible, and he begged Kyle to come in, and Kyle said, reluctantly, okay, I'll do it for 4 months, but that's it. And that's all Ducey was going to get out of it. I'm sorry, I still believe that it was a Kavanaugh pick all the way. And when you pick the Sherpa for Kavanaugh, you know, who had been working the aisles and lobbying for him and everything, and comes right in, and then he's voting for him, I think there's a lot of skepticism about that and frustration and you know, within the Democratic Party, of course, the Kavanaugh appointment is toxic, and so I think that sort of took some of the bipartisan tinge off of Kyle these last 4 months.
It's hard to believe Ducey would have appointed a Republican, though, who wouldn't have voted for Kavanaugh.
Yeah, I guess so. But there were other people that could have served 2 years and 4 months, and that would have given a different image and a different. I'm sitting next to one, in fact, a Republican by the name of Malera, that I think would have been a superb pick.
And he told us he was not in the running. Actually,
yeah, yeah. Well, I gave up my masochist card a long time ago. But stopped paying the dues.
He would have been a superb pick. And there were other people too, you know, I question whether Ducey ever asked Cindy McCain whether she was interested even or not. I don't know that. But I just I wouldn't have gone the Kavanaugh-Kyle route, and that's what Ducey did, and that's what McConnell wanted and what Trump wanted.
Guys, let's talk about a lawsuit filed this week against trying to knock a citizens initiative off the ballot in Phoenix that would basically stop light rail, what the initiative would do. Jaime, what do you make of the fact that the general contractors of Arizona are trying to not allow voters to vote on this issue again.
Well, it's interesting. One of the arguments, or the key argument they're going to be making, is based on strict compliance. And I know a little bit about strict compliance because there was a little Supreme Court lawsuit called Molera versus InvestNed, where we were successful in arguing that because the legislature passed a couple of years ago different thresholds on how do you need to do ballot gathering, how do you need to fill out the paperwork. There's now what's called a strict compliance to make sure, because initiatives are fairly easy to get on the ballot in Arizona. If you have enough money, you can get a lot of things on. And because of the gravity of these issues, where once they pass, Arizona's laws make it almost impossible to change, they're going to be arguing to the courts under that provision that the Supreme Court just ruled on, because they did a couple of things that were not under the guise of strict compliance, I think they might have a good shot at throwing it out.
It's interesting because it's, you know, you're sort of taking the arguments that were used by a lot of Republicans in trying to pass the strict compliance laws in the first place, kind of using them, like almost using those rules against some of those same people, right?
Which is funny because, you know, Sal DiCicco is leading the charge as a very strong Republican. Now he's getting this thrown back in his face that his a lot of his brethren were able to do. The other thing, though, it's a little bit different on the spin of this is not going to allow voters to vote on this. Well, if you think about this, if this initiative gets on, a very small fraction of Phoenix voters are going to be able to vote on this, a very small fraction, because it would be held in March. It wouldn't be held at a regular Phoenix election cycle or in a November cycle where you have a much bigger turnout, where you probably would have a much stronger base of support for mass transit and light rail in this case. So that's one of the other reasons why I think a lot of the proponents are saying, or opponents are saying, this is kind of a sham, where they're just trying to do it in a very off election time where they're going to get a much more conservative base.
And there's also the fact that I think the Phoenix citizens have voted like three different times on light rail and have already blessed it three different times. So it's like every time a controversial route starts to come into development, then you run and get signatures and you try to put it on the ballot and stop the whole thing. But this would muck up, I think, the federal funding for all of light rail if this thing happened to go through. So I think it's fascinating because you got this issue, you've got the Suns Arena, you got the water rate infrastructure mm-hmm. measure that's going to be revoted on in January. These are very big issues that I think will be front and center in the mayor's race mm-hmm. Between Valenzuela and Kate Gallego. Full disclosure, I support Kate Gallego, but she's taken a stand on all these issues. I'm not quite sure where Danny is on the Suns Arena and the water rate increase, but he's going to have to tell us where he stands on those issues, and because that's going to be a determining factor in how people vote for mayor.
And we'll wrap it up there. Chris Hurston, I'm in Malera. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.